I'm really excited to share this episode of the Deeper Dating Podcast with you, where I get to interview my dear friend, Arielle Ford, one of the most inspiring teachers about love, relationships, and intimacy, and a truly wonderful storyteller as well. So stay tuned to this episode.
If you've ever been disillusioned, disappointed, or discouraged in your search for love, and you know there has to be a better way, to find the healthy, soul-filling love you've always longed for, then you've discovered the podcast for you. I know, as Ken's work personally has led me to find the love of my life. So here's your host of Deeper Dating, Ken Page.
Arielle, it is so good to have you here again. You have been a dear friend and a kind of angel to me for quite a long time. I'm thrilled to have you here with me, and your wonderful book, The Love Thief, has just come out. And the themes in that book, for people who have read it, people who haven't read it, the themes are so universal about getting stuck in a bad relationship, finding your way out of it, and then this adventure, the kind of spiritual, personal growth adventure of finding love and finding yourself. So glad to have you here. And I just want to hear everything you have to say about that journey, because you've devoted so much of your personal and professional life to this work, to that journey.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm very excited to talk to you.
Really glad to have you here. So let's jump in. Can you just share with us something about your personal journey to find love? Like what that journey's been for you?
Well, it was never predictable that I would end up as a love and relationship expert, ever. And it was not on my to-do list. I was a first-time bride at 44. I grew up in a family where my parents literally hated each other, had no affection or appreciation for each other. And then when I was 43, I woke up one day and went, oh my God, I forgot to get married. And I decided to focus my attention on manifesting a soulmate, which I did really brilliantly within a year. And actually, in a couple of weeks, we're going to have our 25th wedding anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
But what happened then was once I got married, I discovered that I had no partnership skills. I was an entrepreneur. I had a business. I was really good at being the boss, but I didn't know how to be a good partner. So I put myself on this path to become a student of love. And over the last many years, I have been an excellent student, and I've studied with, really, I've interviewed 200 of the world's top love, marriage, and relationship experts over all these years, and I've taken something valuable from all of them. So that morphed into this world where I now help people find love, keep love, and be love. And because of my dedication to being a student of love, I have a lot of love in my life.
If these ideas feel meaningful to you, I invite you to take advantage of three free gifts that I offer to all of my listeners. Just go to deeperdatinggifts.com to download them all. It's a collection of an ebook on the 5 keys to deeper intimacy, and most of those ideas have gone viral on Psychology Today. And a guided audio meditation led by me of one of the most beautiful, potent practices that I know. And a downloadable personal journal where you can record your insights and reflections. So just go to deeperdatinggifts.com to receive these resources, and I hope you enjoy them. You know, I really relate to that too, because as someone who also ended up getting married, well, for me, it was after 50, it's like 51 or 52. I reached a point that I was kind of knocked down to my knees, and I realized I got to become a student of what's not working here, and I've got to become a student of what does work. So I deeply relate to, and I think that the listeners to this podcast are all students of intimacy. Like, you're here because you care so much about learning about intimacy. And just going back, let's go back to your finding love. You're committing your full focus to finding wonderful love. What are like the 3 or 4 deepest wisdom pieces that you would give for all of the listeners of all orientations, all gender identities, everyone, human beings, about what helps to find healthy love?
Well, for me, the first thing was doing a postmortem on my love history and really seeing what the patterns were and what had worked. And what I discovered when I did that was that I had been living out of my mother's wish list of what a partner should be like, of what she didn't have and what she wanted. So I was I'm not as ambitious as I used to be, but I was a very type A, highly ambitious, very successful entrepreneur. And I thought I needed what Alison Armstrong calls the hairy version of myself, right? I needed a captain of the universe type who was, you know, slaying dragons and making stuff happen and, you know, high energy. And I saw that I would manifest these kinds of boyfriends, but I was always miserable with them. And I was miserable because what my soul most was calling for was somebody who would be devoted to me, somebody who had time for me. And captains of the universe have no time for anybody but themselves. Yeah. So there was always this ongoing struggle of, you know, this powerful woman out there who was actually a very needy person who wanted somebody who was their safe place to land. So once I got clear about what my soul was calling for, then I went about manifesting this being. But it took some processing because I was embarrassed by the fact that I saw that I was a needy person, you know, because it didn't fit with, you know, who I thought I was. And I was just going to say that, you know, I was able to come up with a list of the heart traits and qualities that my soul most needed in a partner. And I was already quite adept at using the law of attraction and manifestation. So I just took all the little prayers, process, and rituals I had done to create the other parts of my life and applied it to my love life. But with this focus of the heart-centered being I needed to call into my life. Does that make sense?
Oh, it's so rich. And I want to kind of take that apart and almost turn that into practices for everybody. So step one that I want to think about here from what you said is what your head is telling you, and maybe it's your mother, maybe it's your father, maybe it's the culture, whatever, like what your head says you need versus what your heart says you need. That is such a fascinating kind of differentiation. Like I could imagine, and even if people want to pause this recording right now and just start thinking like, okay, so what does my head tell me my next partner needs to be like? Now, dropping down, what does my heart ache for in a partner? I think nobody who is single looking for love shouldn't do that. That's a double negative. Everybody who's looking for love should do that gorgeous, gorgeous practice. That's just fabulous. So that's part one, and that's just magnificent. What does your head say you want? What does your heart ache for? What does your heart long for? And then part two is that realization that you're describing, that like the shame place was around the need, around the soft part of you, the part that wanted to be held, that wanted to be cared for, that wanted to be nourished, that wanted to be loved. Like that was a hard one to take in. That's huge. And that must have been humbling.
Oh, it was unbelievable. Because here I was this strong, independent, fierce, you know, slaying dragons kind of person. And really what I wanted was somebody who would sit and listen to me and be devoted to me and care about my feelings and maybe care about my feelings more than I cared about my feelings, you know, because I was just so, you know, in my masculine energy all day long working, which was very satisfying. In fact, I loved my life, even though I was 43 and single. I loved my life 90% of the time. The time when I started to realize I didn't want to be alone was always on a Saturday night at 11 p.m. I'd be driving home from some, you know, big gala screening party, because I lived in LA at the time. And I wouldn't have anybody to share it with. I wouldn't have anybody to talk to. And I was like, starting Monday, I'm going to work on dating. And Monday would come around and I'd get to work and forget all about dating until that morning when I was 43. And I was like, holy shit, I forgot to get married. Let's do something about this. So what I did was I first made a list of all the ways I knew how to manifest. And then I made a list of the heart traits and qualities I most desired in a partner. And some of them, you know, were sort of obvious. I wanted somebody who led a healthy lifestyle. And some of them were kind of crazy. Like I wanted somebody who had English as a first language because I'm a writer. I'm a storyteller. My life is all about words. And I had dated men who spoke English well, but it wasn't their first language. And there were always issues because different words have different meanings and different expression. So the communication part was critical to my long-term happiness. And then I wanted somebody who had a great mother. I wanted like the world's best mother-in-law because I knew somebody like that would know how to treat a woman and would respect women. And my Captain of the Universe boyfriends pretty much never talked to their mothers. So I really went deep with, you know, what is my soul calling for? And at the end of the day, I made a list of 48 items. And then I forgot about it. That's also part of the process, you know, make the list and then do a ritual and release it and forget about it. Until 3 years after Brian and I got married, he came running into my office one day, waving this yellow legal pad. And he was like, I found your list. I found your list. And I'm like, what list? What are you talking about? Your soulmate wish list. And I said, oh, well, how many did I get? He said, you got 46 out of 48. And I said, well, what two didn't I get? He said, well, I'm not Jewish. And I said, well, that's really not an issue because I'm a gastronomic Jew, not a religious Jew. I said, what else didn't I get? He said, and I don't cook. And I said, yeah, but we've never missed a meal. So I got everything. So, you know, people always say, oh, well, you shouldn't ask for too much. Listen, if you don't ask, you don't get. That's my core belief. Why not ask? You're not going to always get everything anyway. And the truth is, even though I got 46 of the 48 items, the things that I didn't know to ask for have turned out to be the greatest gifts. Like I didn't have enough love experience to even ask for what was important. It was just what was important to me at the time.
That's such an important point too, because I really feel like the universe delights in tricking us and giving us someone in some ways different than we expected. And so, but I love that. And I love also naming the things that you would like, but knowing that the universe kind of has a way of like, you know, doing that differently. And one other thing I just want to mention is that, you know, that as we all grow as a world, as a culture, we realize that masculine, feminine traits, which the researchers now are using the words expressive versus instrumental, that those are less linked to biology and genitalia than we ever thought. And that people of all different gender identities have the freedom to express instrumental and expressive qualities, and that it is a field of freedom versus a duality. So just want to make
that's a very point. Technical kind of conversation, which I can't even wrap my head around. I just know for me, with the limited understanding I had, that I could clearly see that I needed to, when I was working all day and producing, and then I wanted to go have dinner with my husband, and then he wanted to talk business over dinner because we had a business together, I could see that it would make me upset and angry because I wanted to not be the work maniac that I was over a romantic dinner. Now, I don't
absolutely
know what there are for that, but so for myself, I created rituals where I would come home from the office, practice my belly dancing, take an aromatherapy bath, and then go to dinner, you know, and I had to get Brian a data book to read so he would stop talking contracts with me over dinner.
Yes,
so whether
yes.
Feminine or masculine, I just know that it was a big learning curve for the two of us to be able to keep the equilibrium in the relationship.
Absolutely. And the woman might need to play more of the quote unquote masculine role because that's who she is. And the man, the more quote unquote feminine, because that's what works for them as a couple. And the research shows that people who interplay as couples are the healthiest, happiest relationships. So just as a queer person, I'm adding in this very kind of, you know, important piece that I think the world is evolving in that direction. And I think it's guys' obligation just as much to soften after work and be present. And you found a guy who could do that. So
yeah, I just totally lucked out because he shows, you know, he's a former pro athlete. You know, he's very, you know, very much a macho kind of guy, just looking at him. But if you spend time with him, he's very beta, you know, and here's all you need to know about Brian. He actually believes that his purpose in life is to make sure that everybody who comes in contact with him has the experience of being loved. That's why he's alive on the planet today.
Which is so beautiful. And to me, like someone who has bypassed what a typical gender expectation should be and moved into who he really is, which is fabulous. So I just want to kind of talk about this adventure. You know, in your book, The Love Thief, one of the things that I adore the most about it is that Holly, the protagonist, has a terrible relationship, a breakup, and then goes on this journey that's very not linear of healing heartbreak, learning about spirituality, learning about finding a center inside that is healing, which I think is such an important human lesson. And you kind of describe the love journey as one of learning and one of adventure and one of possibility. Could you talk about that shift from, I'm going to get my relationship, that's like all I'm going to do, to I'm going to be a student. I'm going to be a student of life. I'm going to be a student of love. Could you talk about that? Because I think that's a really precious thing.
Well, so Holly was a almost 38-year-old single woman whose entire life was the dream of becoming the world's best mom. She wanted the white picket fence. And one night in this very romantic setting, she meets Prince Charming and they fall madly in love until he breaks her heart, crushes her dreams, has an affair with her best friend / business partner, and then she almost dies in a car accident. So on every level, her life has been totally devastated and she doesn't know how she's going to recover. And for the first time in her life, she's experiencing grief and depression and sadness when she's not angry and rageful and ready to kill. And she's not a seeker. She's not a believer. She is the daughter of a new age baby boomer who goes on Esther Hick cruises and used to hang dream catchers over her crib. So she is a reaction to all her mother's spirituality. And yet she ends up in Rishikesh, India, going to cooking school, not even understanding that it's one of the holy cities in India and it's the yoga capital of the world. And while there, she meets a retired professor of counseling psychology who owns the local spiritual bookstore. And they become friends and he becomes her guide and her guru and her shrink.
And you describe that in the book as really kind of a journey, like really a journey. And I would love you to talk about that for everyone who's listening now, who is not in a relationship or is in a new relationship. How do you approach this intimacy journey as an adventure? How do you decenter from, I am just going to get this one dream, this one thing that I want, and like saying yes to this deeper and bigger adventure?
Well, for Holly, she had no choice. She was at the bottom of the pit. She was at a total loss. The only thing she measured every day was her misery level. She tracked, how miserable am I today? So all there was for her to do was to survive the next 5 minutes and the next 5 minutes. And she had totally given up on the possibility of anything. And for me, in my own life, what I've noticed is that the times when I've been at the very bottom, where I thought things couldn't possibly get worse, what I eventually discovered was all of those things. Like if I had to go back and redo my life now, I wouldn't erase those horrible moments because they were the birthing ground for everything I became and who I am and all the joy that I have today.
So, would you be willing to give us one example?
Oh, sure. Yes. In In 1990 or 91, I had a very large, very successful Beverly Hills business. And then the recession hit. And I have a college degree, but not an MBA. I didn't know what a recession was. But what did happen was that in 6 weeks, I lost 80% of my clients. And I had 4,000 square feet of office space, and I had a dozen employees, and no income, and no understanding of where new clients would come from, because my clients love me. They all called with the same conversation. We love you. You're the best at what you do. We can't afford you. So I had to let go of, I let go of my entire staff except for one part-time person.
Wow.
I had to break my lease. And I got an office space that was 300 square feet. It was essentially a closet and office building. And at the same time this was going on, my boyfriend and I broke up and I got Epstein-Barr. So I was sick. I was heartbroken. I was financially broke. I had lost. I was having an ego death because who am I if I'm not the successful business person? And
you were so well.
I didn't know how to fix it or what was going to happen. And I already had my core wound growing up, and to some degree is occasionally now poverty consciousness. So now I'm like, oh my God, am I going to lose my condo? Am I going to lose my sports car? How am I going to pay to get a manicure? I was doing my own nails for the first time since I was seven. You know, everything that could go wrong did go wrong.
Wow.
And so I just, and that lasted for almost a year. And that's when I really started to read more spiritual books and really try to figure out or start to trust God, trust the universe, that out of this horror show, something would come. And it did. It happened when I got my copy of Time magazine, came in the mail one day, and on the cover was the picture of planet Earth taken from space, the big blue ball, the one that we've seen from NASA. And I was looking at the picture of Earth, and I thought to myself, because I didn't know what I wanted to do for a living at that point either, I thought, oh my God, what if I decided that my next career, whatever it's going to be, I will only represent people, places, and things that are good for the planet. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I had this mission statement. I didn't know what that work would be. And then the next day, somebody called and took me to lunch, and they said, oh, well, if you could represent anybody in the world, who would it be? And I said, oh, there's this man. I'm sure you've never heard of him. This is 1991. His name's Deepak Chopra, and I would like to represent him. And my friend said to me, well, strangely enough, I do know who he is. Deepak was not yet famous. He said, my friend Penny works for him. That afternoon, this woman, Penny, called. And she said, oh, Dr. Chopra called me from Boston this morning and said to find him a publicist. And I hear you're a publicist. He'll be in town next week. I'll set up a meeting. I go to the meeting. He's 20 minutes late. He walks in. He doesn't apologize for being late. He looks at his watch and he says to me, I only have 5 minutes. Huh? And I said, I only need two. He said, go. I said, if you're half as smart as I think you are, you'll hire me. And he said, deal. And we went on to work together for 12 years, which was the start of me representing all kinds of famous people, people I made famous in the self-help spirituality world. And we're still really good friends. He texts me all the time. We're still very close. So, you know, would I go back now and change the horror show of losing my business, my health, and my relationship? Absolutely not, because I couldn't have imagined the pivoting my life took once I saw that I wanted to impact the globe on a good level. And then somebody asked me the right question, and one thing led to another.
So there had to be like this radical deconstruction of everything you had built had to happen for you to be able to recreate that. And that's such an important kind of rich thing, is that deconstruction, which feels like hell. It's so painful, just really does push us to grow. And then I guess you're also speaking about the pain period, and then the period of like new insights beginning to bubble. oh, maybe there could be something else. And then kind of the universe conspiring with that. But when the things all fall apart, when that deconstruction happens, it's so hard to see that.
And I didn't see it right away either. You know, all I knew was that I wanted to work with this one person. I didn't know it was going to turn my life into this whole new career. And I think the most important lesson I learned from that whole period of my life was learning to be with not knowing, learning to be okay with uncertainty. And it didn't happen overnight. It's taken me decades, really, of conscientiously wanting to be okay with uncertainty, because I like things to be, you know, black and white. This is how it's going to be. But I see now that the lessons of learning how to be with what is, learning how to dance with uncertainty, surf the waves of uncertainty, to be with not knowing, is the greatest skill I could have ever learned.
Amazing. Who do you find yourself becoming when you can live with that uncertainty? Like, describe the essence of who Ariel becomes when you do that, when you're in that place that you're living with that, like, strange and difficult and often scary edge of uncertainty, but you're in it and you're riding it. Could you talk about the you that you experience?
It's just this sort of lightness of being that isn't there when I'm contracting and in fear and worry and anxiety. So at that point, I have a choice, you know, and I can say, I can notice, oh, yes, my adrenaline's running. I'm in fight or flight. I'm worrying ridiculously. What can I do? And I have this spiritual toolkit that I've built over the years that I use on a daily basis. So it might be EFT tapping. It might be the Sedona method. I might use my HeartMath Inner Balance app to do my deep breathing and focus on feelings of love and appreciation and gratitude. I might be an aromatherapy bath. I might go for a walk. I might just ask Brian for a 20-second hug. I have all these things I can use. But in the past, when I would get to these heightened states of anxiety or fear or whatever it might be, I get out my spiritual toolkit. And it's something I've been building over the decades. And it includes EFT tapping and the Sedona method and HeartMath, my Inner Balance app that I use from them, or an aromatherapy bath, or going for a walk, or asking Brian for a 20-second hug. And I take responsibility for the fact that I'm wigging out, you know, because I know I have a choice. You know, I can go with the negative emotions and feel like crap, or I can take a deep breath, you know, and decide to become an emotionally mature woman. I use my tools. Just like, you know, like you have an outdoor voice and an indoor voice, I get my toolkit out.
I love that. I love that. That's such a rich thought, like everyone really developing their own toolkit. I have a toolkit too that I've developed through the years. So I really, really love that and believe in that. Say something about, like, when you start feeling that in your relationship, when things get difficult, when things get rocky, and one of your fabulous books is, what is the exact title? How to Turn Your Mate into Your Soulmate?
Turn Your Mate into Your Soulmate.
I love that book. I love that book. But in that book, that's something that you talk about a lot. But could you say something about, like, when you're in a relationship and you could feel the part of you gripping and going into old patterns and that choice not to do that? If you could say anything about that.
Well, there's a couple of things. I refuse to engage in anger or negativity when I'm feeling that. So I excuse myself and I go get myself into a heart neutral space. I go and find out, okay, what's triggered me? You know, like where can I own this? Or maybe I don't own it, but I give myself a break. I don't go down that road. So I go and get my spiritual toolkit out. And then I like to practice something that I made up. It's called wabi-sabi love. Wabi-sabi is an ancient Japanese aesthetic that seeks to find beauty and perfection in imperfection. And most of the time, it's related to art or to objects. But with wabi-sabi love, we seek to find the beauty and perfection in our imperfections in both ourselves and our partners. So I'll go and see, you know, like what has to happen here? How can I reframe what's happening? You know, because usually, at least in our relationship, it's not big things that drive us crazy. It's little things that drive us crazy about each other. I'll give you one really fun example, but it was highly annoying. When Brian and I first got together, I would notice, I'll get a little thing to explain this with. I would notice that I'd go into the bathroom and my tube of toothpaste would be mangled from the middle.
Such a guy thing.
Right? And I'd say to him, honey, come here. Let me show you the proper way to get toothpaste out of a tube. And you squeeze from the bottom and then you roll it up and then you get all the toothpaste out and it looks nice. And he would look at me and walk out. I did this about 3 times and I realized that wasn't working. And then I thought to myself, well, you know, why does this bother me? I don't know why it bothers me. I just don't like seeing my toothpaste looking like this. How can I fix it? Well, I thought I'll get 2 tubes of toothpaste, his and hers. But the truth is I would still see his like this and it would bother me. So finally, I decided to talk to the toothpaste and I put the toothpaste in the palm of my hand and I said, okay, toothpaste, tell me what's good about you. And then the toothpaste spoke back to me and it said, thank God you married a man who brushes his teeth. And from that day on, and to this day, because he still does this, every time I see the mangled tube of toothpaste, I smile. Because I realize we're getting old now. We're growing old together, and he still has all his teeth because he brushes his teeth. That's wabi-sabi love.
I love it. I love it. You know, I was on a vacation with my husband and my sister recently, and, you know, so there was a shared bathroom, and she came in and she said, oh my God, you guys literally torture your toothpaste tube. I relate to that. But I love that image. I love that image of finding the wabi-sabi, which is another amazing book you've written, Wabi-Sabi Love, which I adore. So there you are with Brian, and you're beginning to feel it get a little heated. Let's say you're getting irritated and annoyed. Like, at what point do you stop it? I'm just curious about this. How far in do you go? How early do you stop it? How is he with that? And then how do you come back to whatever the issue is?
I stop it as fast as possible. I'm conflict adverse anyway. But, you know, if he's getting irritated with me about something, I tend to get defensive and he gets irritated. So I just get out of there because I don't want to get all defensive. And generally what happens, depending on what side it's coming from, is we apologize to each other very quickly. Neither one of us wants to have an upset, especially over stupid shit, you know, and it's always about stupid shit, you know. And the other thing is that, you know, you learn people's like biorhythms, you know, like Brian smiles in his sleep. He wakes up happy. He's happy most of the day. But if he's ever going to be cranky, it's right before he's going to sleep. I don't know what it is about that time of day. So, you know, there are things that I might want to ask him or talk to him about, and I'll notice, oh, no, it's a couple hours after dinner. It'll wait till tomorrow. So I think, you know, really understanding your partner and being respectful of what's good for them. And then, of course, always asking permission, is this a good time to talk? Or when would be a good time to talk? And
yes. And
turn your mate into your soulmate. I actually have scripts for people to utilize to have difficult conversations.
Yeah. I love that. I love that in the book. Another thing that I love that I'd love you to just say something about really briefly is you talk in a really funny way for long-term couples about sex and the importance of having sex, even if you don't feel like it. Could you say something about the healing nature of sex in a loving relationship? Like, what is it that sex does for a couple that is so healing?
I think it's all about the hormones, you know? You know, the skin on skin, the touching, the feeling. Yeah, and this is something I learned from John Gray, because I love John Gray. I think he's like the funniest person on the planet. And he talks about fast food sex. And he, you know, he's a big proponent of it. He says there's fast food sex
yes. And
then gourmet sex.
Yes.
Now, sometimes even if you just want to use sex as a stress reliever, that's not necessarily a bad thing. And if you want to be a good partner, it's like, well, yeah, sure. It wasn't what I had in mind. And There's other things I'd rather do, but yeah, you want to have a quickie in the laundry room? Then let's just do it, as opposed to, no, I need to be romanced, I need to be this. Just be upfront about it. It's like, you know, this is what I want, and would now be a good time, and if not, when would be, or otherwise, you know.
Yes. So
I think it's about having deep care and respect for your partner.
I think so, too. I think it's an enactment of that. There's some way that sex is this glue. It's this glue that, like, holds love together and holds relationships together. There is a magic to it.
I would have agreed with you when I was much younger, you know, but I'm 70 now. And at this point, you know, it's like that appetite, that need, that drive that I had in my 30s and 40s and 50s that was so like, I'm like, I have to have it. I have to say, at this point in my life, I'm so glad that's gone. You know, now it's just pure choice.
Yes, yes. It's like a fever the other way. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And I have to say, you know, prior to being married, it got me into trouble. You know? So, you know, I think you just have to decide what's right for you and what's right for the relationship, and make your choices out of what's best for the relationship. You know, Brian and I always had this agreement that when it came to big decisions, that we wouldn't do like, what does he want or what does I want? And then we compromise. We would make the decision based on what's best for the relationship.
Beautiful. I love that. Yeah. Well, Ariel, I know we just have a few minutes left. I want to ask you one last question, which is, for all the people on this path of working through relationships and intimacy, what's the message from your heart that just at this moment you most feel compelled to share?
Yeah. So I recently wrote about this in my newsletter. You know, we all know the Beatles song, All You Need Is Love.
Yes.
And I believe that is one of the biggest, fattest lies on the planet. All you need is love. It's a great song. But if you're looking for a long-term, committed, serious relationship, love is not enough. It just isn't. It's not going to get you through. So if you're out there seeking a partner, you want to make sure that it's somebody with whom you have connection, compatibility, chemistry, clear communication. And from the research I've done, the single most important predictor of a long-term relationship working is a shared vision for the future. That's the most important thing. So you could meet somebody and, you know, the hormones are flying and the sparks are flying and, oh my God, I've known you for 3 days. I feel like I've known you forever. You're the one. And you're now having this drug experience. It's your brain on drugs. It's your system on drugs, what I call the socially acceptable form of insanity, thinking that the state of being in love has anything to do with love, which it doesn't. So you've got to be really smart about it. So yes, there's lots of good feelings that come with having a long-term loving relationship, but all you need is love. It's not gonna last.
So I love it. I love your practicality.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ariel. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you for all of the body of work you've put into the world, your new fabulous book, The Love Thief, which I adore and highly recommend. Thank you for being my friend and for being a fairy godmother of love to so many people. And how can people get in touch with you and learn more about your work?
You know, I'm really easy to find. I'm online. It's myname.com, arielford.com is my website. My book site is called thelovethief.com. And if you order the book, there's an incredible bonus package of all these yoga poses to overcome negative emotions. And I'm on Instagram at arielford44.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, Ariel, you are a joy. I'm so grateful for you in my life. I'm so glad to have you on the podcast. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And I look forward to connecting on the next episode. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's episode of Deeper Dating. Be sure to go to deeperdatingpodcast.com as Ken has a few more gifts for you. Then join us on the next episode.